Hi, Year 11. Okay, we're going to be jumping around a bit today, but we're going to start on page 171. I'm not actually going to read from page 171, but maybe if you just jot down in your books that this is what happens during this time, and you can go back and have a look at the interactions and the conversations that happen around this time. They start on page 171. So on page 171, the old man and the boy, they're walking the road as they do, and they come across a man. And on page 171, he describes an old man, small and bent. And you know, he's carrying along a stick for a cane. So they see that he's old and he's on his own. And the father at first is cautious about this because he thinks that it could be a trap. He could be someone working for a bigger group to lure them in. So they follow him along the road for a while, and they don't do anything for a little bit. But then in the end, the boy takes pity on him, keeps telling his papa that the man's just scared, you know, he's just alone, we have to help him. And he, the man ends up pulling over to the side of the road and sitting down, and the boy and the father stop, and they give him the boy convinces the dad, the father, to give him a can of peaches. Anyway, in the end, the boy thinks that that's not enough. And so this is why it would be good for you to perhaps go over these pages if you're looking for evidence on that idea about morality and how that's conveyed, and the idea that the struggle for holding on to those values of kindness and goodness and generosity, even in a depraved human setting such as what we see in the road. So the boy convinces his father that they should help him, and then they do. And during that time, they share a meal with the man. The boy wants to share a meal with them, too. So they do. They share a meal together, and the father and the boy have a conversation. Sorry, the father and the old man have a couple of conversations, which are also interesting to see what the old man's perspective is of the world, because it's quite bleak. Okay. Then we're going to move to page 184. So this is where the father and the boy depart from the man. So I'm going to read from the In the Morning They Stood on page 148 now. In the morning they stood in the road, and the boy argued about what to give the old man. In the end, he didn't get much, some cans of vegetable and some fruit and of fruit. Finally, the boy just went over to the edge of the road and sat in the ashes. The old man fitted the tins into his knapsack and fastened the straps. "You should thank him, you know," the man said. "I wouldn't have given you anything." "Maybe I should, maybe I shouldn't." "Why wouldn't you?" "I wouldn't have given him mine." "You don't care if it hurts his feelings?" "Will it hurt his feelings?" "No, that's not why he did it." "Why did he do it?" He looked over at the boy and he looked at the old man. "You wouldn't understand," he said. "I'm not sure I do." "Maybe he believes in God." "I don't know what he believes in." "He'll get over it." "No, he won't." The old man didn't answer. He looked around the day. "You won't wish us luck either, will you?" the man said. "I don't know what that would mean. What would luck look like? Who would know such a thing?" Then all went on. When he looked back, the old man had set out with his cane, tapping his way, dwindling slowly on the road behind them, like some storybook peddler from an antique time, dark and bent and spider-thin and soon to vanish forever. The boy never looked back at all. Okay, so this is an interesting interaction, I think, that looks at, just looks at this idea of morality. The man believes that the old man should thank the boy for his generosity because, you know, he would have just kept passing him by. And so obviously the boy is demonstrating this inner strength and clinging to these moral values that many people in this world that we've seen of the road, this post-apocalyptic world, don't exhibit. And yet the old man's response is, well, you know, I shouldn't have. Why would I? I wouldn't have done what he did. And that just gives us a sense, this apathy that the old man displays in this interaction where, you know, he's not appreciative because he wouldn't have done it. You know, it's almost implied that he thinks the boy is perhaps stupid for doing it, for being generous, rather than being grateful. You know, he's just apathetic about this instance. When the father says, "You won't wish us luck either, will you?" I think that the old man's response is quite profound when he says, "I don't know what that would mean." On page 185, what would luck look like? Who would know such a thing? I think that really gives us a sense of the dehumanization of society in this world, that all of these pleasantries and, you know, all of these ideas of kindness and generosity are just shadows. They don't exist anymore, and there's no value in it because the old man here clearly doesn't really value the generosity of the boy. And I think the rhetorical question there really conveys that. Who would know such a thing, you know, in a world as this? It's interesting, the simile on page 185 that the father uses to describe the man as they walk away, like some storybook peddler from an antique time, dark and bent and spider-thin and soon to vanish forever. That's really interesting. And then the high modality of the sentence where the boy never looked back at all, you know, that definitive, this instant is... And we don't know, it's not explained there, if he is still angry with his father for not letting them, you know, not letting him give him more food, the man more food. Is he angry that the man will vanish, that he will die? Because later they go on to talk about that they know that he's going to die soon. Or, you know, is he angry that the man didn't say thank you? It's not clear, but there's a sense of... The finality there, the boy not looking back, that he's done this great act of generosity and tried to bond with this man, and yet in the end he just has to break away from that and keep going. Okay, so a couple of interesting things there that you could add to your tables around the ideas that Cormac McCarthy explores. So most of them, I think, link to that idea about the morality and the dehumanization of society. That's something that... you can go back after I finish the podcast and look at in more detail. All right, flip over the page now. And I'm just going to look at the last paragraph on page 186. We're going to read through that and then I'll just quickly talk about it. In the night, he woke in the cold, dark coughing, and he coughed till his chest was raw. He leaned to the fire and blew on the coals, and he put more wood on and rose and walked away from the camp as far as the light would carry him. He knelt in the dry leaves and ash with the blanket wrapped around his shoulders, and after a while the coughing began to subside. He thought about the old man out there somewhere. He looked back at the camp through the black palings of the trees. He hoped the boy had gone back to sleep. He knelt there wheezing softly, his hands on his knees. "I'm going to die," he said. "Tell me how I am to do that." So the coughing comes up again and again throughout the novel, and it gets worse and worse, especially in the second half of the book. The father continually waking, mostly during the night or when they're hiding, talking about how he's trying so hard to suppress this cough, and it's really ominous, this cough. We get, even before he says this line, that this cough is going to kill this man, that he's, you know, he's getting closer and closer to death despite the fact that they're starving. Even if they can find food, that's not going to make a difference for him because he's dying. And so I think this just links to the inevitability of death, you know, that throughout this he's clinging to life for the son, but we know that he's going to die. And this last line of that paragraph there on the top of page 187, "I am going to die," he said, that acknowledgement of the inevitability of death. But this is the struggle, right? The next line, "Tell me how I am to do that." You know, and who he's speaking to, We don't really know there. But he doesn't know how to die. And, you know, you can interpret this how you will. Does he not know how to die? Is he scared? Or is it he's scared for his son? Does he not know how to die and leave his son in a world like this without his protection? You know, I think that for me, that's what I think he's saying here. How am I to do this? How am I to let this happen? But he has no control. You know, eventually he is going to die and he has no control of that. But he doesn't know how to prepare his son, how to let go. And so I think that's just something interesting that I wanted to point out that Cormac McCarthy deals with. You know, and I think it links to the idea of familial love as well, because this idea about trying so hard to care for your children and that innate desire that the father has to just protect his son at all costs, but not everything is within his control, and how long he's with his son isn't in his control. But it's something that he obviously fears for, and that demonstrates just how much love he has for his son. Okay, flip over a couple of pages to page 192. Now, I'm not going to read everything of this paragraph, but I'll get you to come back to this paragraph because Cormac McCarthy, on page 192, the halfway down the page where it says they began to come upon from time to time small cairns of rock by the roadside. From there, just to the end of the next paragraph on page 193, Cormac McCarthy describes essentially the post-apocalyptic world, and he gives a rough summary of how it's come to this point. You know, I'll just read a couple of sentences on page 192. The first he'd seen in a while, common in the north, leading out of the looted and exhausted cities, hopeless messages to loved ones lost and dead. By then all stores of food had given out and murder was everywhere upon the land. The world soon to be largely populated by men who would eat your children in front of your eyes, and the cities themselves held by cores of blackened looters who tunneled among the ruins and crawled from the rubble, white of tooth and eye, carrying charred and anonymous tins of food in nylon nets, like shoppers in the commissionaries of hell. And he goes on to describe the road and to describe the pilgrims sinking down and falling over and dying on the road, and it's a great description, this really poignant description of the post-apocalyptic world that they've lived in. And I think there's so many great quotes here that you could put in your tables for different themes. The one that I just read out, that simile at the end of page 192, like shoppers in the commissionaries of hell, describing the looters, describing the, you know, scavengers that people have become. I think that looks at the dehumanization of society. The world soon to be largely populated by men, quote, who would eat your children in front of your eyes, really links to the destructive nature of violence, doesn't it? And even the idea of morality, this struggle to maintain those core human values, we see that that's lost in this world. And so there's a couple of really great quotes. So I'll get you at the end of the podcast to just note down there, page 192 to 193, and come back and really pick apart that, because there's some great techniques there that he uses to describe the post-apocalyptic world of the road. So come back and have a look at that. Okay, we're going to go a couple of pages on to page 201. So flip with me now to page 201, and this is at the bottom, and this is now dealing with a different idea. It's dealing with the idea of dreams versus reality. So it's just a short extract on page 201 to 202. I'm just going to read from the bottom of the page where it says, One night the boy woke from a dream and would not tell him what it was. You don't have to tell me, the man said. It's all right. I'm scared. It's all right. No, it's not. It's just a dream. I'm really scared. I know. The boy turned away. The man held him. Listen to me, he said. What? When your dreams are of some world that never was or some world that never will be, and you are happy again, then you will have given up. Do you understand? And you can't give up. I won't let you. Okay, this is a really important quote, I think, an important section where the father, because he has these reoccurring dreams, and there is this idea of, the importance of memory versus reality, the significance of holding on to past memories, and the danger of that in a post-apocalyptic world. The father often talks about what he can handle during the day, he can't handle at night. It's too much. But then we also see that he has these dreams of home and his wife and good memories, and they trouble him because he doesn't want good dreams. He thinks that that's a sign that he's dying. He thinks that's a sign that he's going to give up. And so this is where he explains this concept to the boy, almost to reassure him about his horrible dreams, that when your dreams are of some world that never was or some world that never will be, and you are happy again, then you will have given up. And just the emphatic tone of which he says, and you can't give up, I won't let you. It's almost an imperative there, you can't give up. A command that he's giving the son. And again, we see this link to familial love as well, that the on the top of page 202, when he holds him, the man held him, that he's constantly there for him, even during the night, even if it's just a nightmare. So that was just a small point that I wanted to take your attention to. All right, now, this is the stuff of nightmares. I'm going to look at a really horrible extract, so prepare yourselves. But this is the gruesomeness of the road. It's on page 211. So flip ahead. I know I'm moving quickly, but I want us to try and get through the novels so that you can start preparing for your exams. Okay, page 211. They walk to the clearing, the boy clutching his hand. They'd taken everything with them, except whatever the black thing was skewered over the coals. He was standing there checking the perimeter when the boy turned and buried his face against him. He looked quickly to see what had happened. "What is it?" he said. "What is it?" The boy shook his head. "Oh, Papa," he said. He turned and looked again. What the boy had seen was a charred human infant, headless and gutted and blackening on the spit. He bent and picked the boy up and started for the road with him, holding him close. "I'm sorry," he whispered. "I'm sorry." He didn't know if he'd ever speak again. Okay, I just wanted to stop. I know that is horrific, and I'm sorry that I'm not there to unpack this with you in person, because it's horrible, and it's this absolute dehumanization of society. Earlier on, we see the man when the boy is asleep and they're scouting out because they think that there are people following them on the road. He sees the shape of a pregnant lady, and then we come across this. They see the smoke and they go to investigate. The group of four of them, I think there was, were alerted to their presence and ran. But this horrific scene is what we're left with. And I know that you're all thinking, why, Mrs. Reed, have you chosen to draw this to our attention, especially those of you who haven't finished reading the novel, and I apologise. But I just wanted to show you this idea of Cormac McCarthy. Remember I talked to you about how he stripped back everything from the setting in the world in which is the road. We see a contrast to that short story we were looking at with Super Toys, where that's a world filled with all the materialistic and possessions that you could want, and everything at your hands to make life easy and more palatable. That's that world of Super Toys. And yet here, everything has been taken away from people, to the point where that nothing is certain, and they are... Everyone is fighting for their lives, and in that setting, in that, I talked to you about this last week. In that setting, he examines, I think what he thinks humanity is capable of, and we've got two contrasts. We've got the boy and the father, who represent goodness and purity and innocence and kindness and love, right? And maintaining that despite the threat of the world that they live in. And then on the other hand, you've got this horrific, horrific, horrible scene. You can't even palate it. It's just not imaginable, right? But this is what he's exploring, you know, and the extremities of which he does this. And I think that, you think about this, what you think his purpose is. Why would he have this scene? That's something for you to think about. Some ideas for you to you know, toy around with is just that, is this a warning to us? Is this is this calling to us to be like the Father and the Son, to maintain our morality, our sense of what is right and wrong, and do and I think he is imploring us to live a life worthy of what is right. And he is using the horror and the shock value of moments like this, to say that this is what we are capable of as human beings. We are capable of immense good and generosity, but then we are also capable of horror. And, we see that in our world with war, and sometimes we're desensitized to that and detached from that. But these, horrific things happen, and we have history books filled with horrible things that have happened. And in this fictional, speculative setting, I think he's getting us to think, what are we? Are we the good guys or are we the bad guys? Obviously the horror value, I think, is McCormack McCarthy is trying to use this speculative narrative to persuade us to see the reality of what humans are capable of, and to choose the good, to choose what is right. Those are some ideas just for you to throw around about. But, I want you to be thinking about these ideas. Why is he written this almost depressing, horrible novel where we see so much depravity of humanity? Why has he done this? I don't really want to end on a bad note, but on such a horrible note. But the hope that we have is the boy and the father, and that they're carrying the fire, as is continually that metaphor repeated throughout the novel. And we've had this moment of generosity with the son, and they're trying so hard to cling to what is good, despite everything. So that's what I'll leave you with today. I've covered a lot. I'll let you spend the rest of the lesson going back over those pages. Listen to this again if you have to, and add notes to those tables. Tomorrow I'm going to get you to start preparing for a written response to this, and I'll get you to do that by also starting to compare it with Super Toys and the ideas that are explored in Super Toys. Okay. Thanks for hanging in with me, Year 11. I hope that this is making sense, and I hope that this is helping. All right. Thanks very much.